Shrink Wrap Radio number 409. A Gestalt Therapist Reflects on Mindfulness with Dr. Declan Ahern.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Irish psychologist and Gestalt therapist, Dr. Declan Ahern. We'll be discussing his views on the role of mindfulness in psychotherapy. For more background information on Dr. Ahern, please go to our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Declan Ahern, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave. It's my pleasure to be on the show.
And it's my pleasure to have you on the show, which is the result of a very impassioned recommendation that I get you on the show by one of your three sons, Sean, I believe.
Kian.
Kian, is that how you say it?
Okay. Yeah, it's an Irish name.
Yeah, C-I-A-N.
Yeah.
I was so proud of myself. I thought I had correctly decoded it, but not. So at any rate, he said there was this really great psychologist I should interview, and then at the end he confessed that it was his father. And as a father of three sons myself, and we just celebrated Father's Day yesterday. Is that a holiday that you have in Ireland as well?
Yes, yeah, indeed.
And was it yesterday?
Yesterday, yeah, I got lovely wishes from all three of them.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. And I guess he's studying to be a therapist as well, and I was impressed that he had so much pride in his father.
Plus, I'm very proud. I'm very moved by that myself.
Yeah, plus I've been to Ireland a few times, and so I have a special place in my heart for Ireland and the Irish.
Good. Well, Kian is he's a final year doctoral student on the clinical psychology program in the University of Limerick. So he's well on his way now to following in his father's footsteps.
Oh, yeah. That's a real tribute to you. No better Father's Day present than that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're going to be speaking about your interest in mindfulness. But first, I note that you've been a practicing Gestalt therapist for some years. How did you first get exposed to the Gestalt therapy perspective?
Well, that's a really good question, Dave. I started off with a very academic training. I had 3 degrees in psychology before I entered the world of Gestalt psychotherapy. And academic psychology in Ireland is, you know, university degrees in psychology barely touch on the whole area of kind of humanistic psychotherapy back in the 70s. So I came off of my training in clinical psychology feeling that I really did lack some of the basic requirements for having an interpersonal relationship. I knew there was something missing, and I would have read a lot of Pearl's work when I was a student, but never got exposed to it. So I said to myself, even though I was now a qualified clinical psychologist, in clinical psychology here at least, you don't get a full training in psychotherapy as part of your training. So I knew there was something missing. And when I looked into it, I discovered, probably by fate, I was introduced to the wonderful Joan O'Leary, whose husband Owen O'Leary would have trained under Laura Pearls, and she set up a Gestalt psychotherapy program here in Ireland back in the 70s, and it still exists to this day. So I had a wonderful 5 years of training with the Irish Gestalt Centre.
Oh, that's wonderful. And there's sort of two main threads of Gestalt therapy. The one sort of branching out from Fritz Perls and the one branching out from Laura Perls. And they have a somewhat different feel.
Yeah, I think I suppose Fritz Perls built up a reputation of his own dynamic, kind of charismatic and confrontative style.
Yes.
I think that most Gestalt therapists now, the modern Gestalt therapists, moved well away from that notion and has got far more into the relational, dialogical kind of approach to psychotherapy, and I think all for the better. So I would be very much of that ilk in my practice.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with you. I had a chance to see Perls in action just briefly, but it caught up in the time of the late 60s, he made more sense when he was alive than he does in retrospect in some ways. There was something about the zeitgeist that here in California that he could get away with some of his outrageousness that he did.
Yes. But he was a hugely important contributor to the development of psychotherapy, but I mean, he was very extreme. I think now that we've assimilated and integrated his material, we now probably put it to better use than it was being put to even by himself, I would think, you know?
Yeah. And Gestalt therapy certainly had a strong influence on me as a young therapist many years ago. However, it seems to have waned somewhat in popularity and visibility here in the U.S., but I gather it's still very strong in Europe.
It certainly is very strong in Ireland. We have, and throughout Europe, I mean, we had a visiting psychiatrist from Italy recently delivered the most wonderful workshop to us here in Ireland as well. So I know it is strong on the mainland, but in Ireland, there's a very strong Gestalt psychotherapy tradition going back to the 70s. Mm-hmm. Joan would have been one of the founding figures of that, and her kind of empire has spread out and throughout the country, really, you know. So, yeah, it is fairly strong. It is, I suppose it's... it's in competition with something we probably come to talk about a lot, which is every day we get referrals into our practice regarding this dreaded three-letter word, CBT.
Right.
you know, everybody is looking for CBT, and I guess, you know, Gestalt therapy as a pure psychotherapy has probably lost a lot of its valence. We're seeing a lot more of kind of integrative psychotherapy programs now. And less of the pure programs, maybe, you know?
Yeah. And so it sounds like maybe you've got a bit of a stance or an attitude or something about cognitive behavioral therapy. Let's get that out into the open.
God forbid I'd have an attitude about it, no, Dave, but I certainly have strong views in that I'm, you know, having gone through undergrad and postgrad in psychology, I'm well kind of found, my foundations are in behaviorism and learning theory and all of that. So I certainly appreciate the value of that whole reductionist kind of approach to looking at human behavior, and in my day-to-day practice I certainly utilize a lot of cognitive and behavioral intervention programs. I have no difficulty with that. My issue really is with the whole evidence-based practice kind of NICE guidelines. I don't know if you're familiar with NICE guidelines, kind of manualized therapy programs that are being rolled out by public health services. That's my main pet aversion. I think we've done psychotherapy a disservice by hailing CBT to be somehow something marvelous and brilliant, and other therapies that are less amenable to the kind of gold standard RCT type trials tend to get overlooked in funding, and I think that applies to both public funding and probably insurance companies that operate in the States as well, from what I hear.
Yes, and this is a topic that that I've explored with other therapists in this series, and many of the people that I've spoken to would strongly agree with the point of view that you've just expressed, and I agree with it too. I mean, I appreciate the contributions of science on the one hand, and on the other hand, I think that there are subtleties in the transactions of psychotherapy that don't readily lend themselves to the kind of step-by-step manualization that some are advocating.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's only maybe the likes of ourselves who are a bit long in the tooth and we're around a long time that we fully appreciate the depth of what psychotherapy is really about, maybe. You know, I think it takes a lot of time and experience and maybe confidence in our work to get a grasp of what we're trying to do in this whole field. And I suppose I see a lot of people trying to work as scientists, and I suppose I do make the distinction between there's two levels of being a scientist. We use the term local scientist as practitioner, you know, as clinical psychologists, and that's a really good term to use. But a lot of the scientists I see are manualized technicians who are applying scientific methods, but they're actually not practicing as scientists in their day-to-day encounters with their clients. So they're not, you know, they're not utilizing an inquiring mind, a critical mind, and they're certainly not engaging in a scientific methodology in their work. They're actually, all they're doing is applying a science.
Yeah.
I don't know if you could realize the difference of what I'm trying to do, to separate out the two.
Yeah, I do. And that's an interesting way of speaking about it. Well, let's talk about your interest and involvement in mindfulness. How did you first get exposed to the notion of mindfulness?
Well, again, Dave, you know, it goes back to my days as a training psychotherapist in Gestalt therapy back in the late 80s. I suppose I started training in psychotherapy, in Gestalt psychotherapy, in 87. And, you know, we went off on our 10-day training programs, and we would be in community for 10 days. And at the very start of every day, our trainer, Joan O'Leary, and her co-trainer, Hank Romani, would sit us down and do a half an hour of mindful meditation. Now, she didn't call it mindful meditation. It was called bare attention and just attention to the breath. And we did that as a kind of a grounding for our day's work. And I keep saying to young people that I train now in psychotherapy, of all the things I've ever learnt that apply to myself and to my clients, if you ask me what's the most powerful thing I've ever learned, it's the ability to do that. So it was being introduced to that practice that has stood the test of time. And I've been doing that practice myself for the last 25, 28 years. You know, it has stood the test of time. So it kind of came as a surprise to me maybe 10 years ago maybe in Ireland when mindfulness MBSR programs were being rolled out and they were all talking about mindfulness. And myself and my fellow Gestalt colleagues would look at each other and say, gosh, you know, we were doing this 15, 20 years ago. What's so new about this? So that's where basically I began to understand that, you know, Kabat-Zinn, in fairness to him, you know, and a lot of the popularization that is a credit to him, was packaging stuff that's been going on for a long time in other kind of areas, but he's just packaged it really well. But as you know from some of the material I maybe sent you, that I have grave concerns about that packaging, and I think mindfulness is a wonderful thing, but I think it's can be a dangerous weapon in the wrong hands. If you understand,
yeah, let's get into that in just a bit. Now it seems to me, and I think this is maybe what you were just saying, that Gestalt therapy and mindfulness practice have a lot in common, namely absolutely the emphasis on the now.
Well, the emphasis on awareness, yeah, and awareness is in the now. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that's what mindful practice is. Once we understand that, I mean, Gestalt therapy, again, Pearls is very much influenced by Buddhist psychology as well. So, I mean, Gestalt therapy evolved out of that tradition. So it's not like that they're miles apart. They're very similar. And I would see Gestalt therapy as simply being a particular application of mindful practice and probably not done in the same structured way that MBSR program is. But the ingredients are very much the same. You know, we're not talking about a different beast. We're just talking about a different part of the same animal, I think, you know.
Yes, I agree. So have you explicitly integrated mindfulness into your psychotherapy practice? And if so, how?
I've integrated it because no matter who I work with, they would all be trained by me in the practice of mindfulness. So I would make it now a standard practice for me at the start of any of my therapy work is we do our own meditation as for 5-6 minutes. So we just simply start by meditation, and that's a grounding exercise just to bring yourself into the here and now. I would introduce people to the mindfulness-based stress reduction programs as a lot of their homework, but In the actual therapy itself, I tend to utilize my Gestalt work in terms of looking at the contact, which is the one thing I suppose that mindfulness isn't hugely kind of strong on, is the interpersonal relational kind of contact and working on that. So that would be what would happen in the therapy session itself. But as you know, I do deliver an awful lot of mindfulness programs to different groupings. So I provide them to medical students, I provide it to GP trainees, but also I provide it to junior school, primary school children, 4 years to 12 years of age, because I see it as an incredibly useful life skill. And I see it as an incredibly useful introduction to facing our neuroses and facing our fears by learning how to just stop and be with rather than all the time trying to get away from. So that's where I would come from in terms of an ideology about how we try to deal with our neuroses in our society. And I think the danger is that we're always trying to get away from. And I think mindfulness has this incredible truth and wisdom of stopping and facing and being with and learning to live with what is, rather than trying to create the illusion of what isn't.
Well said. What about in your personal life? Are you a regular meditator?
Absolutely. I mean, meditation has been my mainstay. I mean, I'm quite a... I would describe myself as quite a spiritual being. I invest, my life is invested in my own spiritual development. That doesn't mean that I'm a holy Joe by any means. It just means that I value the importance of my spiritual development, and I give it a lot of time and credence, and I hope to encourage that in those around me, my family. So I practice my own meditation daily, and I find that powerful. What I did do in the last kind of 4 years was take up the practice of yoga, and that has really kind of helped integrate a lot more of the kind of holistic notion of mindful practice. So I like that very much, and I continue to do it. I had a lovely yoga session this morning out on the decking of my summer holiday home and in the sunshine. So that was really blissful. But on a day-to-day level, my own practice of meditation, mindful practice, is my bread and butter, and it's what I rely on.
Wow.
It's now, where I turned to, I suppose. I think we need to turn a place to turn to, a reference point, and my reference point is through my meditation. I grew up in a culture where I suppose the rosary was our bread and butter. So I grew up in a traditional Catholic family where we said the rosary every evening, and that was 10 minutes on our knees of prayer. And I suppose in my adult life, I began to lose or to stop engaging in words, because I found words didn't do it for me. And so being present in a spiritual way to me in silence meant an awful lot more. And so I just began to develop my silence rather than my wordiness in my spiritual world.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful. Now, you did send me a copy of a PowerPoint presentation that you gave to a professional organization on mindfulness.
That's right.
Yeah. What was the group you were presenting to?
Yeah, it was our National Association of Student Counseling. As you know, I'm the head of counseling at the University of Limerick, and I'm part of a national executive that coordinates student counseling throughout the country. So we had our national conference last week, and I proffered the delivery of a paper on East meets West because of my interest and my concern around how Western culture was incorporating mindfulness. So I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the presentation because, as you can hear from this discussion, I kind of I get high on these kinds of debates and discussions. So I enjoy it, and it taps into what I have a strong interest in.
Yes. Now, in your presentation, you listed 12 questions, and you're sort of helping me along. You said I could use your questions. So
yeah, absolutely.
That's always helpful. So yeah. I'll make reference to those questions right now.
Yeah.
And but rather than they're sort of stated in yes or no terms, I'm going to let you rhapsodize on them.
Absolutely.
Which I'm sure I'm sure you won't mind. So let's talk a little bit about mindfulness and how and why it's become so popular in the West.
Well, again, back in the 60s, I mean, we were beginning to be introduced to an awful lot of Eastern kind of practices, we had people like Alan Watts writing about Eastern culture and meditative practices. And I suppose the hippie kind of era of the 60s got very interested in that.
Yes.
And the Beatles, I suppose, kind of added to that. But really, it never took off at that point in time, as well as it is now seems to be taking off in our culture. And I think that really, the guy who kind of explained it quite well to me, I suppose, was Wendy Dryden, who did a really interesting historical kind of overview of this journey over the last 20 years, maybe, and looked at how not only did we need an interest in our culture, but also we needed a coming together of a number of different factors. Good scientific journals, good scientific studies seems to have had a major impact, but also a charismatic kind of personality in Kabat-Zinn that was articulate and I suppose speaking to an audience that had an appetite for picking up on this type of material. So I think it was a coming together of lots of things. That at a particular point in time, good marketing probably as well, that
yeah.
just seemed to hit a chord and made it. I suppose the bit that is concerning me is that what has really kind of added to it is the delivery of scientific articles that I keep saying to people, you know, that science has discovered mindfulness in the 1980s. And, you know, the Buddhists discovered 2,500 years ago. So it kind of shows how slow science is really, you know. It takes a long time for science to catch up with wisdom.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Kabat-Zinn, and in your presentation, you kind of raised the question. And by the way, before I go there, I just wanted to, I had a thought when you were speaking before that one of the factors I think that has gone on about this popularization in the West, I agree with everything you said, and kind of an age-related thing. You were talking about you and I being somewhat long in the tooth, and I think what happened is that people of my generation, perhaps yours, who were young students in those days, went on to academic careers, and you know, they were exposed to some of these Eastern ideas and practices and so on, and so they sought to integrate them into their work and to bring some Western/scientific validation to them. And so I think we're reaping the fruits of that right now.
Yeah, maybe it's coming through in that form. You know, I think there's just a combination of factors, Dave, you know, I suppose beneath it, I think we always see waves of interest in various things that become fads, you know. Yeah. I think in our society, and I don't know if we're that far behind the U.S. society in this way, I think there's a craving. I think there's a void. Our church in this country has collapsed in terms of things like attendance at religious practices. Mm-hmm. So there's a void. There's a gap and people are searching.
Yes.
I think every so often something new comes in that people latch onto as part of their search. And my concern is that if they don't understand what mindfulness is ultimately about, they'll come up short. And in 20, 30 years, that'll be out of date and we'll be looking for a new fad. So, you know, I'm trying to address that. That's my kind of my main argument here is that we need to look at what's going on here. I mean, it's a concern that there's both good and bad in it. You know, there's good news, but also there's some concerns. And as you know, these concerns were articulated, you know, nearly 80 years ago by Carl Jung, when he warned us against getting involved in Eastern practices. So I was very much struck by that comment of Jung's in the last couple of years. I came across just reading his Psychology in the East, and I thought, that was an interesting comment. I'd never heard that before, and I delved into it. So, you know, I think Jung was talking about something. I'm not saying Jung was right, but he did issue a warning. You know, I know you have an interest yourself in Jungian psychology.
Yes.
What was that warning about? And what was he speaking about? You know, is it appropriate for Western culture to engage in these practices? Do we know what we're letting ourselves in for?
And that's still an ongoing question, ongoing debate. And I've heard people speak to both sides of it.
Yeah.
I also, like you, have wondered about the possible faddiness of the current interest in mindfulness, which has just exploded. And I've sort of half jokingly suggested that we might be in the midst of a mindfulness bubble.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the real estate bubble and so on. And,
and
yet at the same time, of course, we know that the roots go back so far that, yes, there may be a kind of faddish interest now, but certainly there's something deeper that one way or another will persist, I'm sure. Now, you made reference to the mindfulness-based stress reduction method of John Kabat-Zinn, and you raised the question in your presentation, is this science or is it Buddhist practice?
Yes.
What were you getting at there?
Well, it is interesting, you know, because the point I was making in that, Dave, right, is that as we know, MBSR, as I mentioned, took off because of the scientific journals. And when I read up material, if you look at most of the manuals and the articles and the explanations of mindfulness, they go to great lengths to ensure and to assure people that this is not a religious practice. This is nothing to do. This is kind of evolved out of Buddhism, but it's not about Buddhism. You know, it's strictly science. And I'm saying that's the rock we'll perish on. And I challenged my audience last week and I said, folks, it is about spirituality. It is about Buddhism. What's wrong with us saying that? Why would we shirk from that? That's not a bad thing. But, you know, and as you know, where I'm getting to in this is that we're ultimately looking at how we integrate science and religion. That's the cutting edge of where we need to be going. And if we in the Western world believe that science holds the ultimate truth, that again will be the rock we'll perish on, because those of us, and I mean, I'm not trying to suggest for 1 minute that I have all the answers, but my wisdom and my intuition and my gut feeling tells me knowingly that the answers aren't available in a scientific journal. They lead me and they inform me and they're helpful, but they are not the ultimate answer. Nor is Buddhism, but we've got to find ways of both of these. Amalgamating and working with each other in a way that Ken Wilber describes, in a respectful way of each other. And what I find at the moment is that science tries to distance itself from spirituality and religion. And I'm saying, why do that? You know, because spirituality and religion has for thousands of years helped people find purpose and meaning in life. And positive psychology has constantly reminded us in the last decades that it's those who find purpose and meaning in life psychologically do well. So why do we try to distance it? You know, that's my point. And certainly in Ireland and in the scientific community, maybe at large, there's a kind of an expectation that psychologists are scientists and that we shouldn't be speaking about religion. And all I'm saying is that the human being is, I am, you know, as Declan Ahern, yes, I'm a psychologist. Yes, I am a scientist. Yes, I am a spiritual being with a religious practice. And I can't compartmentalize them outside, one separate from the other. They're all part of who I am. And here we have mindfulness, a beautiful practice that incorporates both of these kind of dimensions. They're a really rigorous discipline with a religious and spiritual underpinning, but also something that makes sense. And I think as scientists, that's what we're trying to do with our world, is make sense of what life is all about. So that I'm trying to look at that and say to people, well, look, let's not disown spirituality and religion as if that's not something we should be talking about as psychologists.
This probably bears on one of the other questions that you raise here, which was, can spirituality be developed outside of religious practice?
Yeah, I mean, and again, that's what I think a lot of mindfulness work tries to emphasize, you know. And I talk about the idea of sanitizing spirituality. And I think if you end up going down that route, you'll end up with manualized spirituality, your manualized practice, which again is like, it's a little bit like painting the Mona Lisa by numbers. You know, It looks great. It looks great, but it's not a work of art. You know, I just follow the numbers, and that will lack something that is crucial to us as human beings: our creativity and our courage and our inspiration that we'll never get out of a manual. You know, we find it within ourselves, and the manuals are there to guide us. So I just think we need to be very, very careful. And this goes, I mean, Dave, this digs deeper. You see, this is about the human frailty that we all have, that we're looking for happiness and we're looking for relief from suffering. And I think that we latch on to anything that will give us the idea that there is some relief from suffering and that we can find kind of the so-called eternal happiness here on earth. And so any fad that offers that is going to find a likely customer. And I think the message really for us all, and you know, no more than Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama, you know, will attest to that, you know, mindfulness isn't some sort of a Mosny holiday camp. Do you know? I don't know if you're familiar with Mosny, but that's a holiday camp that we have here in Ireland and Britain. But like, it's not like going down to Miami or to Fort Lauderdale, like on some sort of a hippie trip. But, you know, life and mindful practice and meditation and all that goes with it is full of challenges and struggles that are part of the human condition. And, you know, that's the first principle in Buddhism, is that suffering is inevitable. So I think we need to be careful that we somehow don't see mindfulness as some panacea. When I did my talk last week, I asked at the very start of the talk, we had just finished a mindfulness workshop, an hour and a half with a wonderful mindfulness instructor. And I asked people, so tell me now, there's maybe 50 in the audience, how many people here found that experience relaxing? And so everybody, I would say, maybe 90% of people put their hand up. They all found it very relaxing. So then I said, now tell me, how many people found this healing and kind of therapeutic? And maybe 40% of people put their hands up. So they found it healing. How many people found it spiritual? How many people found this exercise spiritual? And about 30% of people put their hands up. So I think lots of people find these kinds of practices relaxing. But I mean, you can listen to, you know, the progressive muscle relaxation programs, and they'll give you as much relaxation as a mindfulness program will if you're looking for relaxation. But a lot of mindfulness is ultimately bringing beyond relaxation and bringing it to something more therapeutic and something more spiritual. And I guess not everybody is going to find that on their journey. But I think because one of the points I make in my presentation is that to raise the question that perhaps a lot of our psychological problems do evolve out of a spiritual deficit. And perhaps, you know, what Viktor Frankl talked about, man's search for meaning and purpose is an existential, but also a spiritual struggle. And if we acknowledge that, maybe it'll help us to understand why so many of our young people in Ireland, and I certainly know it's true in my country, I don't know how much it is in California, but, you know, it's the single biggest killer of young men in our society is where they take their own lives. And I believe a lot of that is because we have lost direction. Young people have lost direction, but our leaders have also lost direction. They're not providing the kind of leadership that will inspire young people and show them that life can be lived, even though it can be a struggle. And as you know, in Ireland, we've been through what was called the Celtic Tiger, where we thought that everything we wanted we could buy, and we had all this great economic success. And I think in the last 6 years, we've seen a huge increase in mental health problems because that economic situation has disappeared overnight and people are lost. They're floundering because that's what they had laid all of their confidence and their future down in. And now what do they turn to? And so I think there's a lot of craving and looking for purpose all over again, which in a very unfortunate way, in a kind of ironic way, will lead people back into probably seeking for spiritual answers, because ultimately in our growth, we have our answers will lie in the spiritual domain. I mentioned in my presentation the development continuum, and that continuum moves throughout life from a very physical development and a psychological development, but has to incorporate a spiritual development as well. And if we neglect that, I think our development becomes stunted. And so very much part of my thesis and my hypothesis around how we operate is that a lot of what we're doing in psychotherapy is based around the concept of our ego and our strong ego being all that matters, and that if we ultimately develop the ego, that we have reached a state of individuation. And whilst that's what Jung talked about, I think he was getting very close to, but never acknowledged or maybe fully accepted, that in Western society, we can move beyond that. And that in our culture, we have now developed very egocentric kind of society in the West. And I think the learning from our Eastern culture is that there is another development beyond that, which is ego abandonment. And that, to me, is something that we are going to struggle with in our society, learning about that. And again, I don't know whether you're still following my train of thought.
Oh, but definitely.
Where that would lead to, Dave, is I think what Jung really emphasized, and I was really impressed with what he was saying, was that we don't have to look to the East. Don't practice Eastern culture. Learn from it. But let's not forget that there's a deeply spiritual and mystical tradition in Western culture that we seem to have disowned. We just seem to have disowned it. And the more and more I read this material, I get very annoyed when I read articles that in chapters and books and various people talking about Western culture being identified with individualism and an egocentric type of individuality, which is kind of very much the American dream, perhaps. But that's not that's not what has been fulfilling for me in my life. And I come from a Celtic roots where there's a deep mystical tradition. People like John O'Donoghue in Anam Cara wrote beautifully about it in the last 15 years, a book that was kind of widely read and popular in our bestsellers list. But I don't know if people fully appreciated that this was our own mystical tradition, that people like Thomas Merton, you know, was a great exponent of, and the great William Johnson, who died in the last number of years, a great Jesuit who lived out his life in Japan, but was really working on the whole notion of things like Christian Zen, where he acknowledged the importance of us understanding that within Christian culture, that there is a mystical tradition that doesn't have, and that tradition isn't built around individuality. That yes, we need to develop as individuals, but also we need to move beyond that. And the great irony of our existence is that the Lord, whoever created us, had this great master plan, it seems to me, of developing ego. And you know, building and strengthening your ego, and then, as Jung pointed out, in the second half of our lives, where he said that every one of his patients over 35 came with a spiritual dilemma, a search for meaning, because what we have to do, having built up our ego, is now, in a very ironic way, again, we are told we have to let it go. And the point I would make to both Eastern and Western kind of views is that you can't let go of something you don't have. So you need to have it first before you can let go of it. So I think that's where East and West can. And the other point, I think, David, that I think is crucially important in this debate is that we understand that if in the Western culture, as we have seen in the last 20, 30, 40 years, a great resonance with the mystical Eastern traditions, that can only be because it resonates with something deeply within ourselves, as opposed to being something that's alien to us. So therefore, it's not correct to point to East and suggest, as Jung did, that that's a different psyche to the Western psyche. It's just the yin and the yang. We still have that within us. And the reason I get attracted to originally to Gestalt therapy and after that to yoga therapy and to mindful practice is because it resonates deeply within me. Mm-hmm. And I'm of a Western culture. I've grown up, but as a collective unconscious in myself, I know it taps into something deeply rooted in my own tradition. And I suppose there's a part of me, because I'm a stubborn son of a gun, that I don't want, I've been brought up in a tradition, and I, as a young fella, I got faced with the challenge of, you know, I'll let go of all that baloney, like, you know, all that Catholic stuff, and, you know, move on, and we've moved on into this pluralist society and every man for himself. And a part of me resisted that, and part of me said, hold on a sec, there's something very, very valuable here. Yes, I was brought up in a very solid, good Catholic faith. I just happened to be one of the lucky ones that didn't get contaminated or abused by that church. And therefore, I'm very grateful for a lot of the spiritual development that it afforded me through attending Mass, through engaging in things like rosaries, Lenten retreats, etc. These are part of my culture. And I've learned a lot from them, and they were a tough time. You know, I can assure you, my mother and father dragging me out of bed at 7 o'clock in the morning, every morning that we went to Mass for Lent was not easy. But it gave me something. It gave me a reference point.
Yes.
And I've revisited that over and over and over again in my journey. And all I'm saying is that now that I meet mindfulness, I'm saying that is also a beautiful tradition from another beautiful culture, but we don't have to abandon what's within us. We need to listen to and learn from what those cultures recognize, because there is a tendency in our culture now to disavow or to let go of that ancient tradition, thinking that science in our progress has become focused on the individual. The individual has brought us very, very important things. For example, individual human rights, I think, is one of the huge achievements of our Western culture, something that perhaps isn't as acknowledged in a lot of Eastern cultures. And I think that's something for us to be proud of. But let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. I'm kind of rambling on here a bit, Dave, so I don't know whether...
you're doing such a good job that I'm not interrupting you. And you've covered all the questions that were in your list. And it's tremendously synchronistic, the points that you're making, because Last night I took up a book in preparation for an upcoming interview with the theologian Matthew Fox, who is somebody who was kicked out of the Catholic Church, right? And he's writing about excommunicated is the word I was looking for, and he's writing about Meister Eckhart, whom I didn't know a lot about, but he's one of the people who, and also he was kind of in trouble with the Catholic dogma of his era, but he was somebody who very much was kind of a mystic, and so there's this whole heritage within, as you say, the Western tradition, and within what was, you know, Catholicism at that time, of people who tapped into this mystical experience, which I think is has something to do with going in there yourself instead of taking somebody else's word for it, and encountering something about the divine as a first person experience. And interestingly, you know, a lot of times that put people at odds with the official church.
Yes, and that official church, you know, is going through its own torrid time, and it will like the phoenix rise again in some new form, and we've all got to contribute to that. You know, it's not that I'm wanting to be pushing the Catholic Church. I mean, in looking at the Christian Church in general, you know, I have no particular kind of reason to be have allegiance to any particular church other than the one that I happen to be brought up in. But I think, you know, if I'm a Muslim and brought up a devout Muslim or a devout Buddhist, I think it's the devotion that's important as opposed to the name you put on it. And I think the great religions, they all evolve out of the original prophets were the same for, you know, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims. So, you know, it's not like that they're worlds apart. The messages are the same. And what's wonderful in mindful practice, if we bring it right back to the psychology and the psychotherapy of it, is here we have, you know, what the danger is that it becomes manualized into some set of techniques. But if you read, you know, people like Alicia Goldstein, who I know that you interviewed in the past, and look at and Bob Stahel, and, you know, some fabulous works, even Christopher Gorman, Ronald Siegel, Paul Fulton, some fabulous stuff and writings. But if you listen to what they're saying, they talk about the attitudes that are behind these practices. Mm-hmm. And the attitude of compassion, you know, that's what Jesus Christ talked about. That's what the Buddha talked about.
Yes.
The need for compassion. And that's why wonderful people like the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh have such courage to be able to put this on the world stage and talk about it. I have a wry smile when I hear about Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, meeting the top 15 CEOs of the top corporations in the world. And I'm sure there's a wry smile in his face as they look to seeing about the wisdom, and somewhere in the back of their brains, they're trying to calculate the value of this to their business, you know, and Thich Nhat Hanh in his wisdom, you know, is saying, you know, it is what it is. And you'll take from it if you take from it what is pure and practice what is pure in it, it will ultimately rise above what capitalism is all about. And Thich Nhat Hanh knows that, but, you know, he will drop, the message will fall on many, many heads, and maybe one or two will listen to it. And if that's what it achieves, well and good. I thought one of the most, most bizarre kind of applications of mindfulness was to hear that the Pentagon are now, you know, teaching mindfulness to its soldiers to try and make them more resilient. I mean, how bizarre is that, Dave?
Yeah. Do you know? Yeah, I had a similar thought.
You know, I mean, that's just crackers like that. That's where Western culture gets hold of an idea and markets it and packages it and then tries to sell it as something that has got some wonderful powers. Now, you know, my son and myself are great proponents of mindfulness in sport. And as you know, I mentioned to you, I have a great involvement in sports psychology, and we both have introduced mindfulness into sport, in very effectively. And Kian has published on that himself, and I've used it with professional sports people. But, you know, I like doing that in sports psychology. I think it's a huge, it can certainly benefit people's performance. But the reason, I suppose, I lose some of my energy around it is that ultimately it's only about improving performance in sport. Or perhaps in the army, it's about improving the resilience of your soldiers. But if it doesn't bring the compassion, if it doesn't bring the non-judgmental, empathic acceptance and acknowledgement of the way the world is, it doesn't really contribute to the overall well-being of our community, which is what I'm about. You know, we've got to look, and I think mindfulness has the opportunity to do that. But I can assure you that anybody who goes to read the Gospels will find the exact same message as the Buddha. You know, the messages aren't different. So if people are turning away from the church, whatever Christian church it be, and think that they will turn to mindfulness and find something different, they won't. So that's my only kind of word of caution. And, you know, I think that Jung was onto something. He gave a strong warning to be careful. But I think what was more exciting about what he was saying was, let's acknowledge what we have ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately, as Scott Peck talked about the road less traveled, it's less traveled because it's a tough bloody road. And none of us can, you know, no matter how privileged we are, and I've been very fortunate in my life and very privileged and I've had loads of opportunity, and life is still a struggle. So I don't think for young people that we ought to be presenting some sort of idyllic panacea that's going to take all your cares away. Life is a struggle. And it's our learning to engage with that struggle and doing the best we can with it. Because the people that we see in our clinics are people who've been at somewhere along the line in their journey. And I think I've sent you a kind of a model of my developmental continuum, that there's a development of developing ego and abandoning ego. And in that journey through life, people get traumatized, people get hurt. And some people have huge tragedies early on in life, and it takes all of their powers to just stay alive. Not a mind be looking at kind of abandoning the ego is far from their thoughts, finding a way of existing and finding a way of feeling okay about themselves. Again, having been badly abused, badly traumatized, badly rejected and neglected. You know, that's where we've got to meet those people in our clinics. But I find it helpful to have the overall framework to know where we're going to, because I believe the reductionist approaches of CBT and psychoanalysis as well tend to come up short. They don't recognize that there is movement beyond the ego. And if all we're aimed at in our psychotherapy is developing ego, we will come up short. We will lose our way. And we will only find that we're developing ego to the detriment of a full development of the human person. And that development is as sure as night follows day. As we develop as human beings, as we learn to love ourselves and to feel that we are lovable, the next organic, natural step in our lives is to share that loving with the world. And that's the way it works. And if we stop, if we're stopped from sharing that, and I think mindfulness is helping us to do that, as do the Gospels, we will turn back on ourselves and get disorientated, disillusioned, and fall back into some of our human traps again, the frailties of what it means to be a human being. I find all of that quite exciting, and I feel quite privileged in my day-to-day clinic to have the opportunity to meet people on that journey. I am so privileged to be able to do that and to join them on the journey. I don't have the cures. I don't have all the solutions, but I'm willing to sit with them in their pain, in their struggle, and to say to them, there is some future, there is hope, and there is a way forward. And it's within that overall template that I would work. I don't know whether that appeals to you, Dave, but that's where I'm coming from.
Well, it's very inspiring to hear you speak, Declan, and I would almost wonder if you don't have a congregation somewhere that you address on a regular basis.
What I have to make sure of is that my ego doesn't allow that to happen.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I think you've covered a lot of ground here and really covered the essential ground. And I think your son, Kian, was spot on when he recommended that I speak with you and share you with my audience. So, I want to thank you, Dr. Declan Ahern. Thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio today.
It's been my pleasure, Dave.
Wow, what a preacher man Dr. Declan Ahern is. And I mean that in the best possible way. It was all I could do to keep myself from going hallelujah and amen. He's got that Irish gift of the silver tongue. And once he got going, he really hit all the key points. I don't think I heard anything that I could disagree with. Now, of course, the points that he was making are ones I've heard before, and many of you will have heard before, and I agree with them wholeheartedly. But I think that's the value of a really good sermon. You're not necessarily hearing new things as much as being reminded of deep truths that need to be refreshed from time to time. And that was my experience with Dr. Ahern. I found myself being inspired and recommitted to those truths we hold in common. Once again, I want to thank his son, Kian, for urging me to take on this interview. I can only imagine what a powerful team this father and son duo make and the impact that they'll have on the people they work with there in Ireland. One of the things I really love about doing this podcast and that the podcasting technology makes possible is having international guests like this. What a wonderful learning experience this opens up for us all, breaking down international boundaries and truly experiencing that despite geographic separation, so many of us are on the same page. And I'm also very glad for this interview because I see my mission as not only providing information, but also as being a conduit for the sort of inspiration that we just received from Dr. Ahern. I know that my listening audience is quite varied, and that many people listen not only for information, but also for inspiration and for the nurturance of their souls and the hope to keep hope alive. I know that we all hear something different. We all have different needs, and we tend to hear what we need to hear. My mission here is to set before you a sufficiently bountiful feast that you can find on this groaning board whatever nourishes you. By the way, if you're wondering where Eric, my shrink wrap radio intern, is, I conducted this interview on a Monday, and he has a paying job on Mondays, as well as a couple other days. His gain and our loss, but we'll get him on here when our schedules align.
Dr. Dave, it's Rob Canora. I apologize for not calling sooner, but I did want to take the time to encourage you to continue your podcast. Love listening on a regular basis, and to encourage all your listeners who have not already to take the time to make what should be a one-time donation if you've only listened to one podcast. But if you're a regular listener like me, I encourage you to make an ongoing donation to support your continuing efforts and all the time and effort, obviously, that you put into to delivering such a wonderful regular update on all things psychological. Thanks again for your hard work, and keep it up.
Thank you, Rob Canora. I really appreciate your ongoing listenership and support, and I hope others will be inspired by your example. I love getting audio clips such as the one you just heard from Rob Canora, sharing why they've chosen to donate and encouraging others to do so. I've got some donors out there who haven't sent me an audio clip. So if you're one of them, and maybe the problem is you're shy, just write it out first and then read it. By the way, as I mentioned last time, our message phone number has changed recently. The new number is 415-830-4014, and you'll also find this number under the contact tab on the Shrink Wrap Radio site. As a podcaster, I'm of course a big fan of audio content. Not only do I have a few favorite podcasts that I listen to regularly, but I also always have an audiobook going that I listen to in the car, on walks, at the doctor's office, and so on. And for the past 10 years or so, I've been getting my audiobooks from Audible.com. In fact, I think when I started with them, they probably only had a very limited library. Well, that library has now grown to more than 150,000 titles, and that includes many that are in psychology or related fields. It's fun for me to discover that some of my guest authors from the past are to be found on Audible.com. For example, I recently interviewed Bill O'Hanlon on Shrink Wrap Radio number 402. Just now, I thought I'd check to see if any of his many books are on Audible.com. Indeed, I found his The Change Your Life book there. You can listen to a sample right on the site. In doing so, I learned that this book is a reworking of an earlier book that got him featured on Oprah Winfrey. At an hour and 27 minutes, it's an easy listen, and if you're not already a member of Audible.com, it can be yours for free just by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. You'll get the free book, and you'll also be helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio.
This is Kirsten from Bliss Trips. Settle back and relax. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Kristen. Bliss Trip. I like that. Just hearing it gave my brain a little shot of bliss. For more bliss, let me share a few recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio community. First, we hear from Henrietta in Denmark, who writes, "Dear David, thank you for your podcasts. I'm glad to give a little back. I recently started training as a psychotherapist and introduced your show to my classmates, so there should be some more Danish listeners on the way to your show. Keep up the good work." And that's from Henrietta. And I have a feeling that I may have read that one before. Well, it doesn't hurt to read it twice. I'm so glad to hear from you, Henrietta, and I sure hope I get to visit Denmark before too long. I'd love to go to Copenhagen, as a matter of fact. Next, we hear from Victor, who writes, "Hello, my name is Victor. I've been listening to many of your podcasts over the past couple of weeks and greatly appreciate your work. I'm writing to ask if you're familiar with the writings of Eric Rode." That's spelled R-H-O-D-E. "His psychoanalytic theory is rooted in the tradition of W.R. Bion, but he also incorporates traditional cosmological and contemporary philosophical discourses into his work. I would be very interested to hear an interview with Eric Rode, and I feel that his writings really do need to reach a wider audience." And that, again, is from Victor. Victor sent me some links to some of Dr. Rode's writings. Very European approach to psychoanalysis, and a bit over my head, I have to tell you. I'm just not steeped in that European tradition. So I put it on my list of possibilities, but it's not terribly likely, to tell you the truth. Next, we hear from Megan, who writes, "Hi, I'm a big fan of your podcast. Thank you for providing such an interesting medium to learn more about psychology. I was wondering if you had ever considered interviewing Les Greenberg from Toronto. Take care, Megan." Well, Megan, not only did I consider it, I actually did interview him for my Wise Counsel podcast series, and a wonderful interview it was. At least it was wonderful meeting him and in learning about his years and years of research grounded in the humanistic tradition. So I found it very exciting. That's in my Wise Counsel podcast series that I'm no longer doing, but those archival shows are still available for anyone that would like to hear that interview, and you'll find it at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. And counsel is spelled C-O-U-N-S-E-L. Next, we hear from Paula, who wrote to say, "Thanks for the copy of my University of New Hampshire Dream Lecture that I send out to people when they sign up for our newsletter." And Paula writes, "Dave, I've been a professor at the University of New Hampshire for many years. I was so happy to see you had taught here. Your podcast is a real treasure. A very best, Paula." Well, it was really thrilling for me to hear from a professor at the University of New Hampshire. I have such good memories of the 2 years that I spent there, 1977 to 79. Really hard to believe that it's been that long. But I have many treasured memories from that period, and great to get some respect from a professor there. I love it. Finally, there's one more voicemail. I don't think I've played it before. I hope not, but I will insert it right here.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I am just going to read you the email that I sent you. "I'm a major fan and starving PsyD student at Stanford University. I will have my degree conferred next week, barring any unforeseen catastrophes. I owe you a tremendous debt of gratitude because your podcasts have not only provided much needed entertainment and insight, but giving me the feeling of connecting with like-minded professionals has been invaluable. That grad school process, wow, it was made much more achievable, and I am a better graduate for your wonderful work. I'm going online now to make a donation in celebration of my degree.
And that'll wrap up the email portion of our show for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our new message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks again to Dr. Declan Ahern for his inspiring perspective on mindfulness. In fact, my next guest will be Harvard psychologist Dr. Ellen Langer, and she'll be bringing a somewhat different perspective on mindfulness. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.